the chief said quietly. Boston had a better chance. Sims was at full speed now, with the torpedoes less than 1,000 yards behind. He, too, deployed noisemakers and made radical changes in course and depth. One torpedo went wild, diving after a decoy and exploding on the bottom. The other locked on Boston and slowly ate up the distance. Another bright dot appeared, and that was that.
"Yankee searched the Alpha," McCafferty said, his voice low with rage.
The submarine vibrated with the powerful sonar pulses. "Bearing 109, range 13,000.
"Set.
Match and shoot!" The Alpha didn't wait to hear the incoming torpedoes. Her skipper knew that there was a third sub out there, knew that he'd been pinged. The Soviet sub went to maximum speed and turned east. Chicago's weapons officer tried to move the torpedoes on a closing course, but they had a scant 5-knot advantage on the Alpha, and the math was clear. They'd come up 2,000 yards short at the end of their fuel. McCafferty was past caring. He, too, went to flank speed and chased after her for half an hour, coming down to 5 knots 3 minutes before the torpedoes ran out of fuel. The flow noise cleared off his sonars just in time to hear the Alpha decelerate safely.
"Okay, now we'll try again."
They were 3 miles from the ice now, and Chicago was quiet. The Alpha turned west, and McCafferty's tracking party gathered data to compute her range. The turn west was a mistake. He evidently expected Chicago to run for the pack and safety. "Con sonar, new contact bearing 003.
"Now what, another Russian trap?"
"I need information."
"Very faint, but I got a bearing change. Just moved to 004.
A quartermaster looked up from his slide rule. "Range has to be under 10,000 yards, sir."
"Transients! Transients! Torpedo in the water bearing 005.
"Left full rudder. Maul ahead flank."
"Bearing change. Torpedo bearing now 008.
"Belay that order,"
McCafferty shouted. The new contact was shooting at the Alpha.
"Jesus, what is this thing?"
the sonar chief asked. The Alpha heard the new fish and reversed course. Again they heard and saw the thunder of the Alpha's engines. But the torpedo closed the distance rapidly.
"It's a Brit. That's one of their new spearfish. I didn't know they had any in the fleet yet."
"How fast?" the sonar chief asked.
60 or 70 knots.
"God, let's buy some."
The Alpha ran straight for 3 miles, then turned north to head for the ice. She didn't make it. The spearfish cut the corner. The lines on the display merged again, and a final bright dot appeared.
"Bring her around north," McCafferty told the exec.
"Go to 18 knots.
I want to be sure he knows who we are."
"We are HMS Torbay. Who are you?"
"Chicago."
"We heard the commotion earlier.
Are you alone?"
Captain James Little asked.
"Yes, the Alpha ambushed us. We're alone."
"We will escort you."
"Understood.
Do you know if the mission was successful?"
"Yes, it was."
Chapter 40 The Killing Ground. Stykkishólmur, Iceland. There was much to do, and time was short. Lieutenant Potter and his team of force recon commandos found 8 Russian troops in the town. They were trying to escape down the only road south when they ran into an ambush which killed or wounded 5 of their number. Those were the last who could have warned Keflavik of the ships on the horizon. The first regular troops came by helicopter. Platoon or company-sized units were placed on every hilltop overlooking the bay. Particular care was taken to keep the aircraft below the radar horizon from Keflavik, where a single Russian transmitter remained in operation despite all efforts to the contrary. A CH-53 Super Stallion helicopter airlifted the components of a mobile radar transmitter to a hill on the island's northwest coast, and a team of Army technicians went to work at once to get it operational. By the time the ships entered the rock-filled nightmare called Stykkishólmur Harbor, 5,000 troops were already in position over the handful of roads leading into the town. The captain of one big LST, landing ship, tank,
had tried to count the rocks and shoals on the trip up from Norfolk. He'd stopped on reaching 500 and concentrated on memorizing his particular area of responsibility, known as Green 2 Charlie. The daylight and low tide helped. Many of the rocks were exposed by low water, and helicopter crews relieved of their immediate duties of landing troops dropped radar reflectors and lighted beacons on most of them, which improved matters greatly. The remaining task was marginally safer than crossing a highway blindfolded. The LSTs went first, winding through the rocks at the recklessly high speed of 10 knots, relying on their auxiliary bow thrusters to assist rudder movements to steer the ships through the lethal maze. Again, Lieutenant Potter's team of commandos helped matters. They went from house to house, locating the captains and mates of local fishing boats. The skilled seamen were flown to the lead ships to help pilot the big gray amphibs through the tightest of the passages. By noon, the first LST had her ramp on land, and the first marine tanks rolled onto the island. Right behind them were trucks loaded with steel, pierced plank runway material, which was dispatched east to a flat piece of ground preselected as a base for marine helicopters and Harrier jump jet fighters. Once the fleet helicopters had completed their task of marking the rocks and shoals, they returned to moving troops. The troop carriers were escorted by Sea Cobra gunships and Harriers as they extended the marine perimeter to the hills overlooking the Huitau River. Their contact was made with outlying Russian observation posts, and the first real fighting began. Keflavik, Iceland.
"So much for our intelligence reports," General Andreev muttered.
From his headquarters he could see the massive shapes steaming slowly into view. They were the battleships Iowa and New Jersey, accompanied by missile cruisers for air defense.
"We can engage them now," the artillery chief said.
"Then do so."
"While you can."
He turned to his communications officer.
"Has word gotten out to Severomorsk?"
"Yes, Northern Fleet will sortie its aircraft today, and submarines are being sent as well."
"Tell them their primary targets are the American amphibious ships at Stikisholmer."
"But we are not sure they are there. The harbor is too dangerous for—"
"Where the hell else would they be?" Andreev demanded. "Our observation posts there do not answer us, and we have reports of enemy helicopters moving south and east from that direction. Think, man!"
"Comrade General, the Navy's primary objective will be the enemy carrier force."
"Then explain to our comrades in blue that carrier aircraft cannot take Iceland away from us, but their fucking marines can."
Andreev saw smoke rise from one of his heavy gun batteries. The sound followed a few seconds later. The first Russian salvo landed several thousand yards short.
"Fire mission!"
Iowa had not fired her guns in anger since Korea, but now the massive 16-inch rifles turned slowly to starboard. In the central gunnery control station, a technician worked the joystick controls for a Mastiff remotely piloted vehicle. The miniature airplane purchased a few years earlier from Israel circled 8,000 feet above the Russian gun battery, its television camera shifting from one emplacement to another.
"I count 6 guns. Look like 155 or so. Call 'em 6-inch.
The precise location of the Russian battery was plotted. Next, the computer analyzed data on air density, barometric pressure, relative humidity, wind direction and speed, and a dozen other factors. The gunnery officer watched his status board for the solution light to come up.
"Commence firing."
The center gun of the number 2 turret loosed a single round. A millimeter band radar atop the after director tower tracked the shell, comparing its flight path with the one predicted by the fire control computer. Not surprisingly, there were some errors in predicted wind velocity. The radar zone computer forwarded the new empirical readings to the master system, and the remaining 8 main battery guns altered position slightly. They fired even before the first round landed.
"Mother of God," Andreev whispered.
The orange flash obscured the ship momentarily. Someone to his left shouted, perhaps thinking that one of the Russian artillery rounds had struck home. Andreev had no such illusions.
His artillerymen were out of practice, and had not yet bracketed their target. He turned his field glasses to his gun battery, 4 kilometers away. The first round landed 1,500 meters southeast of the nearest gun. The next 8 landed 200 meters behind them.
"Get that battery moved right now!"
"Drop 200 and fire for effect!" Already the guns were going through their 30-second reload cycle. Inert gas ejected scraps of the silk propellant bags out the muzzles to clear the bores. Then the breeches opened and loading ramps unfolded into place. The bores were checked for dangerous residue. Then elevators from the handling rooms rose to the back edge of the ramps, and the shells were rammed into the waiting gun barrels. The heavy power bags were dropped onto the ramps and rammed behind the shells. The ramp came up, the breeches closed hydraulically, and the guns elevated. The turret crews moved out of the loading compartments and held their hands over their muff-style ear protectors. In fire control, fingers depressed the keys and the breeches surged backwards once more. The cycle began again, the teenage seamen performing the same tasks that their grandfathers had done 40 years before. Andreev stepped outside to watch in ghastly fascination. He could hear the sound of ripping linen that announced the passage of the monstrous projectiles, and turned to look at the battery. Trucks were pulling up to the guns as the crews fired off their last rounds and began frantic preparations for relocating their guns. The battery had 6 152-millimeter pieces and many trucks for the crews and ammunition. A curtain of dirt and rock appeared, followed by 3 secondary explosions, then 4 more salvos as New Jersey joined her older sister in the bombardment.
"What's that?"
A lieutenant pointed to a dot in the sky. The artillery commander tore his eyes away from what had been a third of his heavy guns and identified the remotely piloted vehicle. "I can have it shot down."
"No," Andreev shouted. "You want to tell them where our last SAM launchers are?"
The general had faced mortar and rocket fire in Afghanistan. This was his first experience on the receiving end of heavy guns. "My other batteries are all camouflaged.
I want at least 3 new alternate positions prepared for every gun you have, fully camouflaged, all of them."
The general went back inside the building. He felt confident that the Americans would not shell the city of Keflavik, at least not soon. The map room contained wall-sized charts of the western Icelandic coast. Already his intelligence staff was placing flags to denote the position of suspected American units.
"What do we have on the Huitau?" he asked his operations chief.
"1 battalion, 10 BMD infantry carriers. The rest of the transport is trucks and commandeered vehicles. They have mortars, anti-tank missiles, and handheld SAMs. They are deployed to cover the highway bridge above Bogarnes. The Americans are already looking down at them from this hill.
What sort of aircraft have we seen?"
"The Americans have several carriers within striking distance of us. 24 fighters and 34 attack aircraft per carrier. If they also landed a full division of Marines, we are facing a significant number of helicopters, plus fixed-wing Harriers. These can operate off their amphibious aviation ships or from land bases set up for the purpose. With the right materials, it can be done in 4 to 6 hours. A Marine division is about double our strength in men, 1 heavy battalion of tanks, stronger in artillery, but not so many mortars. It's their mobility that worries me. They can dance all around us, using helicopters and landing craft to place troops anywhere they choose."
"Just as we did when we landed."
"Yes," the general agreed soberly.
"How good are they?"
"The American Marines regard themselves as elite troops, just as we do. Some of their senior officers and NCOs doubtless have combat experience, but few company officers and squad sergeants will have seen any real action."
"How bad is it?"
A new man came into the room. It was the KGB station chief.
"You Czechista bastard! You told me the Marine Division was going to Europe. They're killing my men while we speak."
The distant thunder of heavy guns punctuated Andreev's words. The battleships were shifting fire to a supply dump. Fortunately, not much was left there.
"Comrade General, I... get out of here. I have work to do."
Andreev was already wondering if his mission might be hopeless. But he was a general of paratroops and not accustomed to failure.
He had 10 attack helicopters, all dispersed and hidden after the attack on the Keflavik airfield.
What's our chance of getting someone in to look at this harbor?
We are under continuous surveillance from the American radar aircraft. Our helicopter would have to fly over enemy positions to get there.
The Americans have their own armed helicopters and jet fighters. It's a suicide mission, and it would take a miracle for our man to get close enough to see anything, much less live long enough to tell us something useful.
Then see if you can get us a reconnaissance aircraft from the mainland or satellite support. I must know what we are pitted against. If we can smash their invasion beach, we stand a good chance of defeating the troops they have on the ground. And to hell with their naval aircraft!
It was complicated to do, but a flash information request from the Commander Northern Fleet cut through most of the bureaucracy. One of the two real-time capable Soviet reconnaissance satellites burned a quarter of its maneuvering fuel to alter its orbit and came low over Iceland 2 hours later. Minutes later, the last Soviet RORSAT was launched south from the Baikonur Cosmodrome, and its first revolution took it within radar range of Iceland. 4 hours after Andreev's message, the Russians had a clear picture of what was a raid at Iceland.
Brussels, Belgium.
Are they ready? Sakyur asked.
Another 12 hours would be better, but they're ready. The operations officer checked his watch.
They go off on the hour. 10 minutes.
The hours spent getting the new division in place had been used profitably. Several additional brigades had been assembled into a pair of new polyglot divisions. The front had been almost entirely stripped of reserves to do it, while a hastily thought-out cover and deception plan had radio units all over the front, broadcasting radio messages to simulate the presence of the relocated formations. NATO had deliberately limited its own Maskirovka until now, allowing Sakyur to bet all of Western Europe on a pair of fives.
Hunsen, Federal Republic of Germany.
It was a stimulating exercise. Alexeyev had to move his A exploitation forces forward while a battered B motor rifle division bled to force a crossing of the Weser. All the while, the general waited nervously for news from his shaky right flank. There was none. Sink West was as good as his word, and launched a covering attack against Hamburg to draw off NATO forces from the latest Soviet breakthrough. That was no easy maneuver. Anti-aircraft missile and gun units had been drawn from other sectors. When NATO appreciated what was in the offing, they would break every effort to prevent a Soviet advance on the Ruhr. Resistance so far had been light. Perhaps they didn't understand what was happening. Or perhaps, Alexeyev thought, they really were at the end of their personnel and logistical string. The first A unit was 120th Motor Rifle, the famous Rogachev Guards, whose leading elements were just now crossing at Rula, and right behind was 8th Guards Tank. Two more tank divisions were bunched on the roads to Rula, while an engineer regiment labored to erect 7 bridges. Intelligence estimated 2, perhaps 3, NATO regiments coming to meet them. Not enough, Alexeyev thought, not this time. Even their air power was depleted. His frontal aviation groups reported minor opposition only around Rula.
Perhaps my superior was right after all.
Heavy enemy air activity at Salzhemmendorf, an Air Force communications officer reported.
That's where 40th Tanks is, Alexeyev thought.
The B unit had been badly chewed up by the German spoiling attack. 40th Tanks reports a major enemy attack underway on its front.
What do they mean by major?
The report comes from the alternate command post. I can't reach the divisional HQ. The assistant commander reports American and German tanks advancing in brigade force.
Brigade force? Another spoiling attack?
Enemy attack in progress at Dunsen.
Dunsen?
That's close to Gronau.
How the hell did they get there?
Alexeyev snapped. Confirm that report. Is it an air or ground attack? 120th Motor Rifle has a full regiment across the Weser. They are advancing on Brockelm. 8th Tank's leading elements have the Weser in sight. SAM units are setting up to cover the crossing point.
It was like having people read different parts of the paper to him simultaneously, Alexeyev thought. General Beregovoy was at the front, coordinating traffic control and setting final assignments for the post-crossing maneuver. Pasha knew that was his proper place, but, as before, he was annoyed to be far from the real action, giving orders like a party boss instead of a fighting commander. The artillery from all the advancing divisions was well forward to protect the crossing against counterattack.
My rear areas are awfully weak.
Comrade General, the attack at Dunsen is composed of enemy tank and motorized troops with heavy tactical air support. The regimental commander at Dunsen estimates brigade strength.
A brigade at Dunsen? And a brigade at Salzhemmendorf?
Those are B-unit commanders. Out of practice, inexperienced. If they were really effective officers, they'd be in A-units, not shepherding out-of-shape reservists. Enemy ground units at Bremke. Strength unknown.
That's only 15 kilometers from here.
Alexeyev reached for some maps. It was cramped in the command vehicle, so he went outside and spread them on the ground with his intelligence officer beside him.
What the hell's going on here?
His hand moved across the map. That's an attack on a 20-kilometer front.
The new enemy division is not supposed to be in place yet, and theater intelligence says it will be broken up for spot reinforcement use all over the northern front area.
Headquarters at Folzehausen reported a heavy air attack and went off the air. As if to emphasize this latest report, there was a massive explosion to the north in the direction of Bremke, where 24th Tanks had its main fuel and ordnance dump. Suddenly, aircraft began to appear low on the horizon. The mobile command post was in woods overlooking the small town of Hunsen. The town was largely deserted, and the unit's radio transmitters were there. NATO aircraft had so far shown a reluctance to damage civilian buildings unless they had to.
Not today.
4 tactical fighters leveled the center of the town, where the transmitters were, with high-explosive bombs.
Get alternate one going immediately, Alexeyev ordered.
More aircraft swept overhead, heading southwest toward Highway 240, where Alexeyev's A units were moving toward Rula. The general found a working radio and called Sink West at Stendal.
We have a major enemy attack coming southeast from Springa. I would estimate at least 2 division strength.
Impossible, Pasha. They don't have 2 reserve divisions.
I have reports of enemy ground units at Bremke, Salzhemmendorf, and Dunsen. It is my opinion that my right flank is in jeopardy, and I must reorient my forces to meet it. I request permission to suspend the attack at Rula to meet this threat.
Request denied.
Comrade General, I am the commander at the scene. The situation can be managed if I have authority to handle it properly.
General Alexeyev, your objective is the Ruhr. If you are not able to achieve that objective, I will find a commander who is.
Alexeyev looked at the radio telephone receiver in disbelief. He had worked for this man 2 years. They were friends. He's always trusted my judgment.
You order me to continue the attack regardless of enemy action?
Pasha, they make another spoiling attack. Nothing more serious than that.
Get those 4 divisions across the Weser, the man said more gently.
Out.
Major Sergeyev, Alexeyev called.
The young officer appeared a moment later.
Get yourself a vehicle and head for Dunsen. I want your personal observations on what you find.
Be careful, Ivan Mikhailovich. I want you back here in less than 2 hours. Move.
You will do nothing else? The intelligence officer asked.
Pasha watched Sergeyev board a light truck. He could not face his officer.
I have my orders. The operation to cross the Weser continues. We have an anti-tank battalion at Hola. Tell them to move north and be alert for enemy forces on the road from Bremke. General Beregovoy knows what he's supposed to do.
If I warn him, he'll change his dispositions. Then Beregovoy will be blamed for violating orders.
That's a safe move. I prudently pass on a warning and...
No. If I can't violate orders, I cannot co-opt someone else into doing so.
What if they're right? This could be another spoiling attack. The Ruhr is a strategic objective of vast importance.
Alexeyev looked up.
The battle orders stand.
Yes, Comrade General.
The report of enemy tanks at Bremka was incorrect. A junior officer came over. The observer saw our tanks coming south and misidentified them.
And this is good news? Alexeyev demanded.
Of course, Comrade General, the captain answered lamely.
Did it occur to you to inquire why our tanks were heading south? God damn it, must I do all the thinking here?
He couldn't scream at the right person. He had to scream at somebody. The captain wilted before his eyes. Part of Alexeyev was ashamed, but another part needed the release. They had the job because they had more battle experience than anyone else. It had never occurred to anyone that they had no experience at all in this sort of operation. They were advancing. Except for local counterattacks, no NATO unit had done very much of that. But Lieutenant, he still thought like a sergeant, McCall, knew that they were best suited to it. The M1 tank had an engine governor that limited its speed to about 43 miles per hour. It was always the first thing the crews removed. His M1 was going south at 57 miles per hour. The ride was enough to rattle the brain loose inside his skull, but he'd never known such exhilaration. His life was balanced on the knife edge of boldness and lunacy. Armed helicopters flew ahead of his company, scouting the route, and pronounced it clear all the way to Alfeld. The Russians weren't using this route for anything. It wasn't a road at all, but the right-of-way for an underground pipeline, a grassy strip 100 feet wide that took a straight line through the forests. The tank's wide treads threw off dirt like the rooster tail from a speedboat as the vehicle raced south. The driver slowed for a sweeping turn while McCall squinted ahead, trying to see whatever enemy vehicle the helicopters missed. It didn't have to be a vehicle. It just could be three guys with a missile launcher, and Mrs. McCall would get the telegram, regretting to inform her that her son... 30 kilometers, he thought. Damn. Only a half hour since the German grenadiers had punched a hole in the Russian lines, and zoom goes the Black Horse cab. It was crazy. But hell, it was crazy to have stayed alive ever since his first engagement, an hour after the war started. 10 clicks to go.
Look at that! More of our tanks southbound. What the hell is going on? Sergeyev snarled to his driver, even talking like his general now.
Are they our tanks? The driver asked. The new major shook his head. Another one passed through the gap in the trees. The turret had a flat top, not the usual dome shape of Soviet tanks.
A helicopter appeared over the gap and pivoted in the sky. Sergeyev didn't mistake this for a Russian, and the stubby wings on either side of the fuselage marked it as an armed attack chopper. The driver lurched to the right just before the nose-mounted machine gun flashed at them. Sergeyev jumped clear as the tracers reached out. He landed on his back and rolled toward the tree line. His head was down, but he could feel the heat blast when the machine gun tracers ignited the spare gas tank on the back of the truck. The young officer scampered into the trees and looked around the edge of a tall pine. The American helicopter flew to within 100 meters of his vehicle to ensure its destruction, then spun off to the south. His radio was in the overturned, burning truck.
Buffalo 3-1, this is Comanche, over.
Comanche, this is 3-1, report, over.
We just popped a Russian truck. Everything else looks clear. Roll 'em, cowboy, the helicopter pilot urged.
McCall laughed at that. He had to remind himself that this wasn't really fun. Quite a few tank drivers had gotten into trouble by getting just a little too unwound on the German countryside. And now they were being ordered to. 2 more minutes and 3 kilometers passed.
Here's where it gets tricky.
Buffalo 3-1, we show 3 Russian vehicles standing guard on the hilltop. Look like Bravo Tango Romeos. All the bridge traffic seems to be trucks. The repair shop is on the east bank north of the town.
The tank slowed as they came to the last turn. McCall ordered his track off the road, onto the meadow grass, as it edged ponderously around the stand of trees.
Target BTR, 11 o'clock, 2700. Fire when ready, Woody.
The first of the 8-wheel vehicles exploded before any of their crews knew a tank was near. They were looking for aircraft, not enemy tanks 40 kilometers in the rear. The next two died within a minute, and McCall's platoon of 4 tanks dashed forward. They all reached the ridge 3 minutes later. One by one, the huge Abrams tanks crested the hill overlooking what had once been a small city. Many days of continuous air attacks and artillery fire had ended that. 4 ribbon bridges were in operation, with numerous trucks crossing or waiting to cross. First, the tanks located and engaged anything that looked even vaguely dangerous. Machine gun fire began working on the trucks, while the main guns reached into the tank repair yard established in the fields north of the town. By this time, 2 full troops were in place, and infantry vehicles took on the trucks with their light 25-millimeter cannon. Within 15 minutes, over 100 trucks were burning, along with enough supplies to keep a whole Russian division in business for a hard day of combat. But the supplies were incidental. The rest of the squadron was catching up with the advance party, and their job was to hold this Russian communications nexus until relieved. The Germans already had Gronau, and the Russian forces east of the Lina were now cut off from their supplies. 2 of the Russian bridges were clear, and a company of M2 Bradley infantry carriers darted across to take up position on the eastern edge of the town. Ivan Sergeyev crawled to the edge of the grassy road. He didn't know what it was, and watched the units pass while his stomach contracted into an icy ball. They were Americans, at least a battalion in strength, he estimated, traveling light. No trucks, just their tracked vehicles. He kept his wits enough to begin a count of the tanks and personnel carriers that raced before him at a speed that he'd never really appreciated before. It was the noise that was most impressive. The turbine-driven M1 tanks did not make the roar of diesel-powered tanks. Until they were a few hundred meters away, you couldn't even know they were there. The combination of low noise and high speed.
They're heading towards Alfeld. I have to report this.
But how? His radio was gone, and Sergeyev had to think for a minute to determine where he was. 2 kilometers from the Lina, right across that wooded ridge. His choice was a difficult one. If he returned to the command post, it was a walk of 20 kilometers. If he ran to the rear, he might find friendly units in half the time and get the alarm out. But running that way was cowardice, wasn't it? Cowardice or not, he had to go east. Sergeyev had the sickening feeling that the alarm had not been sounded. He moved to the edge of the trees and waited for a gap in the American column. It was only 30 meters to the far side. 5 seconds to cross the gap, he told himself. Less. Another M1 blazed past him. He looked left and saw that the next was nearly 300 meters away. Sergeyev took a deep breath and ran into the open. The tank commander saw him but couldn't get to his machine gun fast enough. Besides, one man on foot without even a rifle wasn't worth stopping for. He reported the sighting on his radio and returned to the mission at hand. Sergeyev didn't stop running until he was 100 meters into the trees. Such a short distance, but he felt as if his heart would spring from his chest. He sat down with his back against a tree to catch his breath and continued to watch the vehicle pass. It took several minutes before he could move again. Then it was up the steep hill, and soon he was once more looking down at the Lina. The shock of seeing the American tanks was bad enough. What he saw here was far worse. The Army tank repair yard was a smoking ruin. Everywhere there were burning trucks. At least it was downhill. He ran down the east side of the ridge, right up to the river. Quickly stripping off his pistol belt, Sergeyev leaped into the swift current.
What's that? Hey, I see a Russian swimming!
A machine gunner swiveled his .50 caliber around. The vehicle commander stopped him.
Save it for the MiG, soldier.
He climbed up the east bank and turned to look back. The American vehicles were digging into defensive positions. He ran to cover and stopped again to make a count before proceeding. There was a traffic control point at Zak. Sergeyev ran all the way. After the first hour, things settled down. Lieutenant McCall got out of his tank to inspect his platoon's positions. One of the few ammunition carriers to accompany the troop stopped briefly at each tank, its crew tossing out 15 rounds each. Not enough to replace what they'd fired, but not bad. The air attacks would be next. Crews were out chopping down trees and shrubs to camouflage their vehicles. The accompanying infantry set out their Stinger crews, and Air Force fighters were already circling overhead. Intelligence said that 8 Russian divisions were on the west side of this river. McCall was sitting on their supply route. That made it a very important plot of real estate. USS Independence. Quite a change from the last time, Tolan thought. The Air Force had an E-3 Sentry operating out of Sondrestrom to protect the fleet, and 4 of their own E-2C Hawkeyes were also up. There was even an Army-manned ground radar just coming up on Iceland. 2 Aegis cruisers were with the carriers, and a 3rd with the amphibious force.
"You think they'll hit us first, or the Fibs?" Admiral Jacobson asked.
"That's a coin toss, Admiral," Toland replied. "Depends on who gives the orders. Their Navy will want to kill us first. Their Army will want to kill the Fibs." Jacobson crossed his arms and stared at the map display. "This close, they can come in from any direction they want." They expected no more than 50 backfires. But there were still plenty of the older Badgers, and the fleet was only 1,500 miles from the Soviet bomber bases. They could come out with nearly their maximum ordnance loads. To stop the Russians, the Navy had 6 squadrons of Tomcats and 6 more of Hornets, nearly 140 fighters in all. 24 were aloft now, supported by tankers, while the ground attack aircraft pounded Russian positions continuously. The battleships had ended their first visit to the Keflavik area, and were now in Hallfjordr, Whale Bay, providing fire support to the Marines north of Bagarnes. The entire operation had been planned with the likelihood of a Russian air-to-surface missile attack in mind. There would be more vampires. The loss of northern Norway had eliminated the utility of real time. The submarine was still on station gathering signal intelligence, but the task of spotting the outbound Russian bomber streams passed on to British and Norwegian patrol aircraft operating out of Scotland. One of the latter spotted a 3-plane Vic of Badgers heading southwest and radioed a warning. The Russian aircraft were roughly 70 minutes from the fleet. Tolan's station in CIC was immediately below the flight deck, and he listened to the roar of jet engines overhead as the fighters catapulted off. He was nervous. Toland knew that the tactical situation was very different now from that on the second day of the war. But he also remembered that he was one of the 2 men who'd escaped alive from a compartment just like this. A flood of information came into the room. The land-based radar, the Air Force E-3, and the Navy E-2s all linked their data to the carriers. There was enough electromagnetic energy in the sky to cook the birds in flight. The display showed the fighters proceeding to their stations. The Tomcats reached out to the northern Icelandic shore, curving into loitering circles as they awaited the Russian bombers.
"Ideas, Toland. I want ideas," the Admiral said quietly.
"If they're after us, they'll approach from the east. If they're going for the Fibs, they'll come straight in. There's just no percentage in deceptive tactics if they're heading for Stikkisholmer." Jacobson nodded.
"That's how I see it."
The pounding on the flight deck continued overhead as strike aircraft landed to rearm for new bombing strikes. Aside from the expected material effect, they hoped to wreck the morale of the Soviet paratroopers by violent and continuous air attacks. Marine Harriers were also in action, along with attack helicopters. Initial progress was somewhat better than expected. The Russians did not have their troops as widely dispersed as they'd thought, and the known concentrations were being subjected to a hurricane of bombs and rockets.
Starbase, this is Hawk Blue 3. I'm getting some jamming, bearing 024. More jamming now.
The data was linked directly to the carrier, and the thick yellow strobes came up on the electronic display. The other Hawkeyes quickly reported the same information. The fleet air ops officer smiled thinly as he lifted his microphone. His units were fully in place, and this gave him several options. Plan Delta. Hawk Green 1 carried Independence's air wing commander. A fighter pilot who would have much preferred riding his Tomcat for the mission, he directed two fighters from each Tomcat squadron to seek out the Russian jamming aircraft. The converted Badgers were spread on a wide front to cover the approach of the missile-armed bombers and advanced at 500 knots, 300 miles now from the line of radar picket aircraft. The Tomcats homed in on them at 500 knots as well. Each jammer created a strobe, an opaque wedge shape on the U.S. radar screens, so that they looked like the spokes of a wagon wheel. Since every such spoke was particular to each of the radar transmitters, the controllers were able to compare data, triangulate, and plot the position of the jammers. The Tomcats closed in quickly while the radar intercept officers in the back seat of each fighter flipped the Phoenix missile seekers to home on jam guidance mode. Instead of depending on the aircraft's own radar for guidance, the missiles would seek out the noise transmitted from the Badgers. 20 jamming aircraft were plotted. 18 fighters headed for them, targeting at least 2 missiles at each. Delta, execute. The Tomcats launched on orders 40 miles from their targets. Once more, Phoenix missiles streaked through the air. Flight time was a mere 56 seconds. 16 of the Badger jammers went off the air. The surviving 4 all switched off when they saw the smoke trails of missiles and dove for the deck with Tomcats in pursuit. Numerous radar contacts. Raid 1 is 50 aircraft, bearing 009. Range 360. Speed 600 knots. Altitude 30,000. Raid 2, the talker went on as the enemy aircraft were plotted.
We have the main raid, probably Badgers going for the fibs. This one will be backfires. They'll try to launch on us, probably far out to draw our fighters off, Toland said. Jacobson spoke briefly to his operations officer. Hawk Green 1 would control the defense of the amphibious force. Hawk Blue 4 from Nimitz would defend the carrier groups.
The fighters divided according to plan and went to work. Toland noted that Jacobson was leaving control of the air action to the officers in the control aircraft. The fleet air defense officer on USS Yorktown controlled the SAM ships, all of which went to full alert, but left their radar transmitters on standby.
"The only thing that worries me is they might try that drone crap again," Jacobson murmured.
"It worked once," Toland agreed. "But we didn't have them this far out before."
The Tomcats divided into 4 plane divisions, each controlled by radar. They, too, had been briefed about the drones that had fooled Nimitz. The fighters kept their radars off until they were within 50 miles of their targets, then used the radars to locate targets for their onboard TV systems.
"Hawk Blue 4," one called. "Tally-ho, I got eyeballs on a backfire. Engaging now. Out."
The Russian plan of attack had anticipated that the American fighters would try to burn through the jamming aircraft to the north, then be caught off balance by the appearance of the backfires to the east. But the jammers were gone, and the backfires did not yet have the American carrier fleet on radar and could not launch their missiles on the basis of hours-old satellite photographs. Neither could they run away. The supersonic Russian bombers went to afterburner and activated their radars in a contest with time, distance, and American interceptors. Again, it was like watching a video game. The symbols designating the backfires changed as the planes switched on their own protective jammers. The jamming reduced the effectiveness of the Phoenix missiles, but Russian losses were already serious. The backfires were 300 miles away. Their radars had an effective range of only half that, and already fighters swarmed over their formations. Tally-ho calls cluttered the radio circuits as the Tomcats converged to engage the Russian bombers, and the carrot symbols started dropping off the radar screens. The backfires closed at 17 miles per minute, their radars searching desperately for the American fleet.
"Going to get some leakers," Tolan said.
"Six or eight," Jacobson agreed.
"Figure three missiles each."
By now the Tomcats had fired all of their missiles and drew off for the Hornets to join the action with Sparrows and Sidewinders. It wasn't easy for the fighters to keep up with their targets. The backfire's speed made for difficult pursuit curves, and the fighters were notoriously short on fuel. Their missiles continued to score, however, and no amount of jinking and jamming could defeat all of them. Finally, one aircraft got a surface radar contact and radioed a position. The seven remaining backfires fired their missiles and turned north at Mach 2. Three more fell to missiles before the fighters had to turn away. Again the vampire call came in, and again Toland cringed. 20 incoming missiles were plotted. The formation activated jammers and SAM systems with a pair of Aegis cruisers on the threat axis. In seconds, they were launching missiles, and the other SM-2-equipped SAM ships added their own missiles to the basket, allowing their birds to be guided by the Aegis computer systems. The 20 incoming missiles had 90 SM-2s targeted on them. Only three got through the SAM cloud, and only one of them headed for a carrier. America's three-point defense guns tracked the AS-6 and destroyed it 1,000 feet from the ship. The other two missiles both found the cruiser Wainwright and exploded her 4 miles from Independence.
"Damn." Jacobson's face took a hard set. "I thought we had that one beat. Let's start recovering aircraft. We've got some dry fighters up there."
Everyone's attention turned to the Badgers. The northern Tomcat groups were just coming within range of the older bombers. The Badger crews had expected to follow their jammers in, reversing earlier tactics. Some were slow to realize that they had no electronic wall to hide behind, but none had a choice. They detected incoming fighters while still 5 minutes from their launch points. The Badgers held course and increased to full speed to lessen their time of vulnerability while their crews looked anxiously for missiles. The Tomcat pilots were surprised that their incoming targets were not altering course, which made the possibility of drones seem even more likely. They closed to get visual identification of their targets for fear of being tricked again into shooting at drones.
"Tally-ho, Badger at 12 o'clock and level!"
The first Tomcat loosed a pair of missiles from 40 miles out. Unlike the backfires, the Badgers had a location fix for their targets, which enabled them to launch their AS-4s from maximum range. One by one, the 20-year-old bombers launched and turned as tight as their pilots dared to escape. Their escape maneuvers allowed half to survive, since the Navy fighters were unable to pursue. Aboard the radar aircraft, kills were being tallied even as the missiles flew toward Stikis Homer. Soviet naval aviation had just taken fearful losses. USS Nassau. Edwards was still in the twilight of anesthesia when he heard the electronic gonging of the General Quarters alarm. He was only vaguely aware of where he was. He seemed to remember the helicopter ride, but his next impression was that of lying in a bunk with needles and tubes stuck in various parts of his body. He knew what the alarm meant, and knew intellectually that he should be afraid. But he couldn't quite work his emotions up through the drug-induced haze. He succeeded in raising his head. Vigdis was sitting on a chair next to his bed, holding his right hand. He squeezed it, not knowing that she was asleep. A moment later, he was too. 5 levels up, Nassau's captain was standing on the bridge wing. His normal battle station was in CIC, but the ship was not moving, and he figured that this was as good a place as any to watch. Over 100 missiles were inbound from the northeast. As soon as the raid warning had been received an hour earlier, all of his boat crews had set to lighting off the smoke pots set on the rocks in this so-called anchorage. That was his best defense, he knew, hardly believing it himself.
The point defense guns at the corners of the flight deck were in automatic mode. Called R2-D2s for their shape, the close-in weapons system Gatling guns were elevated 20 degrees, pointing off to the threat axis. That was all he could do. It had been decided by the air defense experts that even firing off their chaff rockets would do more harm than good. The captain shrugged. One way or another, he'd know in 5 minutes. He watched the cruiser Vincennes to the east, steaming in slow circles. Suddenly, four smoke trails erupted from her missile launchers, and the missile firing cycle began. Soon the northeastern sky was a solid mass of gray smoke. Through his binoculars, he began to pick out the sudden black puffs of successful intercepts. They seemed to be coming closer, and he noticed that the missiles were too. And the Aegis cruiser could not get them all. Vincennes emptied her magazines in 4 minutes, then bent on full speed to race between a pair of rocky islands. The captain was amazed to see it. Someone was taking a billion-dollar cruiser into a rock garden at 25 knots, even off Guadalcanal. An explosion rocked the island of Frapsi, 4 miles away. Then another on Sele. It was working. 10 miles up, the Russian missiles switched on their radar seeker heads and found their target windows crammed with blips. Overloaded, they automatically scanned the largest for infrared signatures. Many of the blips gave off heat, and the missiles automatically selected the largest for their attention as they made their final Mach 3 dives. They had no way of knowing that they were attacking volcanic rocks. 30 missiles got through the SAM defenses. Only 5 of them actually aimed themselves at ships. 2 of Nassau's R2-D2s swiveled together and fired at a missile traveling too fast to see. The captain looked in the direction of the barrels, just in time to see a white flash 1,000 feet overhead. The sound that followed nearly deafened him, and he realized how foolish it was to be exposed when fragments dinged off the pilot house next to him. 2 more missiles fell into the town to his west. Then the sky cleared. A fireball to the west told him that at least 1 ship had been hit. But not mine. Son of a bitch. He lifted the phone to the Combat Information Center. Combat Bridge, 2 missiles fell into Stickish Homer. Let's get a helo over there. There's going to be some casualties. As Toland watched, the tapes of the air engagement were replayed at fast speed. A computer tallied the kills. Everything was automated now. Wow, the intelligence officer said to himself. Not like before, was it, son? Jacobson observed. Spaulding, I want word on the fibs. Just coming in now, sir. Charleston took a hit and broke in half. We have minor damage to Guam and Ponce. And that's it, Admiral. Plus Wainwright. Jacobson took a deep breath. 2 valuable ships and 1,500 men were gone. Yet he had to call it a success. Keflavik, Iceland. The attack should be over by now. Andreev didn't expect rapid information. The Americans had finally succeeded in damaging his last radar, and he had no way of tracking the air battle. His radio intercept crews had copied numerous voice transmissions, but they'd been too faint and too fast for any conclusion other than that a battle had in fact been fought. The last time we caught a NATO carrier force, we smashed it, the operations officer said, hopefully. Our troops above Bogarnus are still under heavy fire. Another reported. The American battleships had been hitting them for over an hour. They are taking serious losses. Comrade General, I have a... You'd better listen to this. It's on our command circuit. The message repeated 4 times in Russian. Commander Soviet Forces Iceland, this is Commander Strike Fleet Atlantic. If you don't get this, somebody will get it to you. Tell your bombers, better luck next time. We'll be seeing you soon. Out. Zak, Federal Republic of Germany. Sergeyev staggered up to the traffic control point in time to see a battalion of tanks move down the road toward Alfeld. He stood slumped over, hands on his knees, as he watched the tanks roll off. Identify yourself! It was a KGB lieutenant. The KGB had taken over traffic management. The authority to shoot violators came easy to the KGB. Major Sergeyev, I must see the area commander at once. Attached to what unit, Sergeyev?
Ivan stood up straight. Not Comrade Major, not Comrade, just Sergeyev. I am personal aide to General Alexeyev, Deputy Commander West. Now get me the hell to your commander. Papers. The lieutenant held out his hand, a coldly arrogant look on his face. Sergeyev smiled thinly. His identification documents were in a waterproof plastic envelope. He handed the top card over to the KGB officer. It was something his father had managed to get for him before mobilization. "And what might you be doing with a Class 1 priority pass?" The lieutenant was wary now. "And who the fuck are you to ask?" The son of a Politburo member brought his face to within a centimeter of the other man's. "Get me to your commander now, or we'll see who gets shot here today." The Czechist deflated abruptly and led him to a farm cottage. The commander of the traffic control station was a major. Good. "I need a radio on the Army command circuit," Sergeyev snapped. "All I have is regimental and division," the major answered. "Nearest division headquarters?" 40th Tanks at... "It's destroyed. Damn, I need a vehicle. Now! There is an American force at Alfeld." "We just sent off a battalion." "I know. Call them back." "I have no such authority." "You damn fool, they're heading into a trap. Call them now." "I don't have the off—" "Are you a German agent? Haven't you seen what's going on there?" "It was an air attack, wasn't it?" "There are American tanks in Alfeld, you idiot. We must launch a counterattack. But one battalion isn't enough. We—" The first explosion started 6 kilometers away. "Major, I want one of two things. Either you give me transport right now, or you give me your name and service number so that I can denounce you properly." The two KGB officers shared a look of incredulity. Nobody talked that way to them, but anyone who did... Sergeyev got his vehicle and raced off. Half an hour later, he was in the supply base at Hola. There he found a radio. "Where are you, Major?" Alexeyev demanded. "Hola. The Americans got through our lines. They have at least one battalion of tanks at Alfeld." "What?" The radio was silent for a moment. "Are you certain?" "Comrade General, I had to swim the damned river to get here. I counted a column of 25 armored vehicles a few kilometers north of the town. They shot up the tank repair station and massacred a column of trucks. I repeat, General, there is an American force at Alfeld in at least battalion strength. Get transport to Stendal and report personally to Commander-in-Chief West." USS Independence. "Good evening, Major Chapayev." "How's the leg?" Toland asked, sitting down beside the hospital bunk. "Are you being treated properly?" "I have no complaints. Your Russian is... fair." "I do not often get to practice with a Soviet citizen. Perhaps you can help me somewhat." "Major Alexandra Georgievich Chapayev," the computer printout read. "Age 30. Second son of General Georgi Konstantinovich Chapayev, commander of the Moscow Air Defense District. Married to the youngest daughter of a Central Committee member, Ilya Nikolaevich Govorov. And therefore probably a young man with access to lots of under-the-counter information." "With your grammar," Chapayev snorted. "You were the commander of the MiGs?" "Be at ease, Major. They're all finished now. You know that." "I was the senior flying officer, yes." "I've been told to compliment you." "I'm not a flyer myself, but they tell me your tactics over Keflavik were excellent. I believe you had 5 MiGs." "We lost a total of 7 aircraft yesterday, 3 to MiGs, 2 to missiles, and 2 to ground fire. Considering the odds, we were disagreeably surprised." "I had my duty." "Nah. We all have our duty," Toland agreed. "If you are concerned at how we will treat you, you should not be. You will be treated properly in all respects. I don't know what you have been told to expect, but probably you have noticed once or twice that not everything the party says is completely true. I see from your identification papers that you have a wife and 2 children.
I have a family,